Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for September the 30th, 2018. Yes, the last day of September. Welcome to October, and welcome to our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we travel from City Hall to the State House all the way out to the White House. So, time to grab that Sunday paper, get that cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Well, you can definitely feel the fall in the air. It is quite something. Football kind of weather, a little bit of drizzle this morning, temperatures falling into the 40s at night, and of course, I've got a cold.
Well, not only that, the other night there was a frost warning for the far western suburbs.
Yeah, and I have to tell you, I was curious the other night how cold it was, so I checked in on a far-flung forecast for you, Dave. I checked in on Askove, Minnesota, Aunt Jo's home.
Oh, yes.
29 degrees.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I got a Facebook post from a friend who is way up north in northern Michigan and northern Wisconsin doing a lighthouse tour up there, and it was in the 40s. During the day, for a high, it was only in the 40s up there, way, way up north. You know, the UP, Lake Superior area there.
A lighthouse tour, that sounds great.
Oh, yeah, there's lighthouses around the Apostle Islands that are just beautiful. And around northern Michigan, all through the UP area there, too, and the Keweenaw Peninsula.
Ah, what's not to love about the UP, right?
I know. The Youpers.
The Youpers. The Youpers. Beautiful country. Beautiful country. But, yeah, I decided to make a big pot of chicken noodle soup. And it actually did a little bit for me overnight.
Warms you up inside.
Yes, yes,
makes you feel all good and cozy.
Some of those big Kluski noodles. Yeah. Just perfect. Just perfect. So that's all to lay the base for my trip over to Chicago Gourmet later today.
Last year it was hot. This year it's cold.
Last year it was
rainy.
Last year it was like 93 degrees with 70% humidity. And now, now today is wearing a sweater and a hood and hopefully not having to bring the umbrella out. But I'm looking forward to it. I actually am. It's just such a fascinating festival, as Sam Toya talked about last week on the show. It's one of my favorites in Chicago. But, of course, I'll be also looking at my WGN radio app and seeing what's going on in the sports world. You got enough to do today, Andy?
Yeah, there's nothing happening. I mean, I really wish there was something going on. You know, I wish there was a closer baseball race. I wish the Bears were playing. I wish the Ryder Cup was going on. Oh, wait. All that is actually happening.
And I have to tell you, this is like the first time because there's been so much going on, it's like the first time I didn't watch any of the Ryder Cup.
Yeah,
but then I realized that after the, you know, now I hear they're coming back, but mm-hmm. it seemed like I didn't really miss much by not watching it earlier.
No. And the Americans haven't won on in European soil since 1993. Davis Love III was a real young man back then. And it's funny, they were just showing a clip on the Golf Channel that was saying that young Davis Love III with a huge putt. I'm like, wait a minute, he's not young anymore.
Yeah, right.
25 years since the last time the Americans won there. Right now they're leading in three of the matches going on. A couple of them are all square. It hasn't been a very good situation for the Americans. And yesterday they made that little charge toward the end, but that was really about it.
Well, Cubs.
Yeah.
But and now we've got two divisions in the National League that are coming down to today.
Correct. In the National League West also, it's the Rockies and the Dodgers. Both teams are in the playoffs. Same situation for the Cubs and the Brewers. I don't want people to get the wrong impression. I mean, it's not a win-or-go-home thing. It's a win or maybe be the wild card, and that's not something you want to be, especially in a one-game situation.
Right.
The Cubs, I believe, would host both 163 and a wild card if that came down to it. but you don't want that to happen. It's if the Cubs and the Brewers both lose, they'll be here tomorrow.
Right.
If the Cubs and the Brewers both win, they'll be here tomorrow. And if the one team wins, obviously they win the division.
What I don't like is how Milwaukee is playing an interleague end of season.
Yeah. It's, the way the schedule works, and, it's not even just an interleague series. It's Detroit, and Detroit is just not very good.
Right.
I mean, they're part of the American League Central right now that seems to be basically the Indians in rebuilds with right. the White Sox and the Twins and the Royals and a little bit of the Tigers, although I don't think the Tigers are really in official rebuild mode. I think they're just kind of bad, actually.
Yeah.
But they've run into a real hot team in the Brewers, and it just seems like a lot of the breaks are going the way that Christian Yelich is threatening the triple crown of the National League, and he's only a couple runs batted in behind Javi Baez, who has 111. He leads in home runs now and is very close in the batting average as well. So, you don't really want to have to face the Brewers in a one-game situation. No. You'd rather have them play the one-game deal and come face you if you get a chance to kind of get your rotation set and get things in order.
Right, right. Now, it's and I thought the Dodgers had run away with the West, and I was very surprised at just looking at the standings today,
mm-hmm.
and I did not see Colorado making the moves that it did.
Yeah, Colorado making the playoffs for two straight years now with an old friend of mine, Buddy Black, at the helm. And it's interesting, too, because the neither of the expansion teams that came in 1993 have won their division ever. I mean, the Marlins have won two World Series, but they've won them both as a wild card team. And the Rockies got to the playoffs back in 07, and eventually got to the World Series as a wild card team.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so right now they're tied. Each team is 90-71. And the Brewers and the Cubs, both 94-67, going into the craziness of today.
Who could imagine you'd get 94 wins and you wouldn't have the division?
That's true. Do you remember back, I believe this was 1993, the Dodgers and the Giants came down to one game. The Dodgers won it in 93 with 104 wins, and the Giants had 103. And this was before the wild card.
Wow. Wow.
I'd like to win 103 games during a regular season and not make the playoffs.
Oh, man. Unbelievable. And of course, now I did not mention the Bears last weekend mm-hmm. when I was here, and I'm wondering whether that I should mention them at all this time, given that they're the first place Chicago Bears.
Yeah. First time that they've been over 500 since the last year of, dare I mention his name, Mark Trestman's last season.
Who?
Wow. Yeah.
Wow. There's memory lane.
Yeah.
Who's that?
Yeah.
Exactly. And he's the king of Canada, basically. He wins great cups like they're handing him out.
Right.
But, they're 2-1, and I don't think that they've gotten the offense to the point where they need to get their offense.
No, not at
offense.
All. Not at all.
So this defense is winning games for him.
Which is, like I said, I think Bears, I think defense. I love that defense, and it can overcome problems on the offense, but I think Trubisky looks just
average.
I don't want to be ungenerous, but
he looks average.
He looks like he's trying to lawyer every play.
Yeah, he's got happy feet. I don't think he's quite set with the offense yet. And it's interesting. Somebody pointed out to me yesterday that it took Alex Smith, the quarterback at Kansas City, and now he's moved on as well to San Francisco. It took him a while to grasp the Matt Nagy offense. It took him three seasons, two of which he was sitting, and one which he played. So, I don't think it's going to take Trubisky 3 years. I think they've kind of, I hate to use this term, but they've kind of dumbed down the offense a little bit this
right.
year. They simplified it a little bit this week, and hopefully that'll make a difference because, the Buccaneers' offense has been rolling with the backup quarterback, Ryan Fitzpatrick. He's thrown for over 400 yards in all three of the games so far. And Jameis Winston is now eligible to play again. He was suspended the first three games of the season by the NFL.
Right, right, right.
So they're not even sure who they're going to start today. Or they know, but they're not telling anybody.
Right, exactly, exactly. Well, I hope the defense is ready to play today. That's
Khalil Mack's
sure.
pretty good, isn't he? he's pretty good.
Pretty good?
Yeah, he's pretty good.
He's real good. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a game changer for this team.
Yeah, he's a monster on the field. I mean, you have to account for him every time. You have to account for him whether it's a passing play or a running play because he has proven equally effective in both defenses, the run game and the pass game. And he is a disruptor. I mean, this is a guy that looks for the football and has already forced fumbles, recovered fumbles, picked off a pass. I mean, this guy is doing it all. Thank you, Raiders. Appreciate it.
Yeah. And Gruden's going, you know, where's our defense?
Yeah, we don't need that guy. No, we don't need him. Yeah, the heck you don't.
Yeah, good call there. Good call there. And it was I was not unhappy to see the Vikings lose on Thursday night to the Rams.
Yeah, too bad. I tell you what, the Rams are really good.
Where did they come from? Yeah, all of a sudden.
They started this trend last year. Todd Gurley, their running back, had a tremendous, tremendous season. And Jared Goff, the number one pick overall, finally playing like a guy that has a little bit of a mission in front of him. And he's been doing very well. And they're a team to be reckoned with in that in the West. I mean, they're pretty good, and they showed the Vikings that you can't just come into the L.A. Memorial Coliseum and expect to win a game against the Rams.
Right, right, right. What's the spread today?
Let's see. That's a good question. I haven't even looked that up.
I think it was 3 points.
I'll tell you in 1 second here.
But I was curious because I know the Bucs can be good. I just don't know how we rank anymore.
Three points. Bears favored by 3.
Well, okay. That's the home field, so it's
correct.
Even
so it's
game.
A pick'em. It's basically it's a pick'em game. And if you're into these kind of things, 46 is the number.
46. All right. Well, I'll be snacking on the food and then, watching all of that. Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. That's Andy with all the sports. Producer Tom is in for Casera today, fielding your phone calls at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin, and we're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is here pushing all the buttons and also bringing me the box of Kleenex. You can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com. You can also find our podcasts at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Just up ahead on the show, after the 7:30 news and sports, we'll be speaking to a good friend of the program, David Yepsen. David's the former national political reporter and columnist for the Des Moines Register and former head of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at SIU Carbondale. He's now the host of Iowa Press, and we'll be talking about the events in Washington as well as some of the Illinois politics that's going on as well. By the way, I want to let you know, David will be on a panel that I'm hosting Monday evening at Aurora University along with NBC5's Marianne Ahern and WTTW's Amanda Vinicky. We'll be talking about the role of media in politics and how we try to do our jobs in a ever-changing environment, not just the media landscape, but the political landscape as well. And you can find more information about that at alumni.aurora.edu, and you can find information on that panel tomorrow night, and look forward to seeing all of you out there. Up ahead on the show, after the 8 o'clock news, we'll speak to Republican State Senator John Curran of Downers Grove, and he's among the local officials calling for action dealing with Sterigenics in Willowbrook, and we'll talk about the issues going on there. And then after the 8:30 news, we'll be speaking to Democratic State Comptroller Susana Mendoza. She was part of a panel that was convened of Democratic women who were looking at issues involving sexual harassment reporting, as well as ways to get women more involved in politics. That's all up ahead. Time to launch our spin through the national political world with, of course, the powerful, if not historic, hearings in the Senate Judiciary Committee over Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court and Christine Blasey Ford's allegation that he sexually assaulted her 36 years ago. On Friday, the Senate Judiciary Committee advanced Kavanaugh's nomination to the Senate floor, but of course that's with the caveat retiring Arizona Senator Jeff Flake insisted that he would vote only on the condition of a one-week limited FBI background investigation. That was quickly supported by other Republican senators critical to the outcome, and President Trump asked the FBI to investigate. Here is Jeff Flake.
The Democrats who have been, I think, justifiably uncomfortable moving ahead could publicly, in an effort to bring this country together, say that we would feel better. I'm not expecting them to vote yes, but not to complain that an FBI investigation has not occurred. And this is what I'm trying to do. This country's being ripped apart here, and we've got to make sure that we do due diligence. I think this committee has done a good job, but I do think that we can have a short pause and make sure that the FBI can investigate. My understanding is that some of us would have to, and I'm prepared to do it, make a request to the White House to ask the FBI to do that investigation. It would be short and limited in scope to the current allegations that have been made.
Mr. Chairman.
But I would just encourage the Democrats who we talked to before to endorse that kind of thing, that we can then move on.
That's Arizona Senator Jeff Flake. While he says limited in scope, the president says that the FBI basically has free rein in its investigation. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. The FBI has begun contacting people as part of that additional background investigation, according to the Washington Post. The Bureau, in addition to the allegations raised by Christine Blasey Ford, the Bureau has also contacted Deborah Ramirez, a Yale University classmate of Kavanaugh's, who alleges that he shoved his genitals in her face at a party where she'd been drinking and became disoriented. That's according to her attorney, saying that the FBI has reached out to them. So we've got that as a background. At the same time, you had Ford delivering some powerful and emotional testimony as she appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
I am here today not because I want to be. I am terrified. I am here because I believe it is my civic duty to tell you what happened to me while Brett Kavanaugh and I were in high school. I've described the events publicly before. I summarized them in my letter to Ranking Member Feinstein and again in a letter to Chairman Grassley. I understand and appreciate the importance of your hearing from me directly about what happened to me and the impact that it has had on my life and on my family.
Illinois senior U.S. Senator Dick Durbin asked Ford directly if she was certain that it was Brett Kavanaugh who assaulted her.
The Republican staff of this committee released to the media a timeline that shows that they've interviewed two people who claim they were the ones who actually assaulted you. I'm asking you to address this new defense of mistaken identity directly. Dr. Ford, with what degree of certainty do you believe Brett Kavanaugh assaulted you?
100%.
Kavanaugh, for his part, delivered a forceful defense and denial, but he also gave a partisan spin to the attack on the allegations leveled at him.
This confirmation process has become a national disgrace. The Constitution gives the Senate an important role in the confirmation process, but you have replaced advice and consent with search and destroy. Since my nomination in July, there's been a frenzy on the left to come up with something, anything, to block my confirmation. Shortly after I was nominated, the Democratic Senate leader said he would, quote, oppose me with everything he's got. A Democratic senator on this committee publicly referred to me as evil. Evil. Think about that word. And said that those who supported me were, quote, complicit in evil. Another Democratic senator on this committee said, quote, Judge Kavanaugh is your worst nightmare. A former head of the Democratic National Committee said, quote, Judge Kavanaugh will threaten the lives of millions of Americans for decades to come.
That's Brett Kavanaugh. Joining me now on the phone is David Yepsen. He's the host of Iowa Press, former director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at SIU Carbondale, and former national political reporter and columnist at the Des Moines Register. David, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
It's good to be with you, Rick.
Quite dramatic events in Washington to close out the week. And we all know that a Supreme Court nomination is a political process. But I've never seen a nominee so overtly critical about the politics of the process.
I don't think there has been. Judge Kavanaugh has raised, well, he, I don't want to say he lost it, but he was clearly angry. And in lashing out the way he did, to Republicans, he speaks the truth. Democrats are saying, well, this shows he doesn't have judicial temperament. I don't know, Rick, if any reasonable person had gone through what Judge Kavanaugh has in this confirmation process, you might be entitled to a little bit of anger.
Yeah, and I think, too, the anger was in part probably encouraged by, you know, through the training he was getting to show, you know, that he was indignant about these charges. But having to walk that delicate line about not directly attacking his accuser.
Well, that's true. But remember, part of Judge Kavanaugh's audience in that was the one person who sits in the White House who was looking for a little more fire out of his nominee. And so the judge had to look judicial while at the same time keeping Donald Trump happy by looking tough and forceful. Those sorts of things are important to the president. And President Trump has, after that appearance, came out and tweeted that he was happy and this was fine. So the judge, any talk of withdrawing that nomination is on hold now.
Right. There is no plan B, the president says. It's you know, and even Jeff Flake, who, you know, in kind of that dramatic last-minute wrangling in the Senate Judiciary Committee that resulted in this FBI investigation, even Flake is saying, was out yesterday saying that barring anything that was disturbing in the FBI investigation, he intends to vote for Brett Kavanaugh.
Yeah, and I give Senator Flake some credit here. He's taking heat from people in his party, but that's nothing new for him. I think he's right. This thing is ripping the country apart, is not healthy for the process. I'm not sure we've had this kind of tension in American politics since the Vietnam War and the Civil Rights era. People are angry, they're opinionated, the dialogue, the spectacle of that committee hearing. So I think Senator Flake gets a little credit for trying to cool things off a little bit and have a rational, reasonable look at this thing, not in having the FBI take a look at it, and then come back and letting senators make their decisions. Then I give him some credit.
Well, and I think, you know, obviously there was that kind of what looked like a rush by the Republicans to get this done. They wanted to get it done. And, I mean, you had Mitch McConnell, we're going to plow ahead on this. And, you know, it seemed like at least what's the argument about, what does it hurt if the FBI takes another look at this guy or looks at these allegations?
Well, but unless it's being used as a delaying tactic, I think it's important to note that to Republicans and to many people in the Republican base, the Supreme Court is the reason they're in politics. This is job number one. This is the holy grail. Get that Supreme Court back. It's been true for years. You know, Republicans have made no secret about the fact they want to change the direction of the court. Here's their chance to do it. Whether you like it or not, they won the election, and they're going to get their person on the court. And so anything that smacks of trying to delay it, and there are some who argue that all the Democrats are trying to do here is delay this thing in the hopes of winning the 2020 election. I think Senator Graham made that pretty clear. So I don't think you can underestimate the passion that Republicans have for getting their nominee on that court. At the same time, you can't underestimate the passion that exists on the left and in the Democratic Party that they don't want to see that court flip in that direction.
And there's still the feelings about Merrick Garland, too.
That's right. And, you know, just one thing after another, and you can see how the passions in American politics are really at the white-hot level. And so, you know, Senator Flake tried to cool things off. He may have an agenda of his own. I know he's in New Hampshire, or scheduled to be in New Hampshire.
Right.
And in fact, he's been mentioned as a possible challenger to President Trump. We haven't seen him out here in Iowa yet. So he may have an agenda of his own, but so what? It's not a crime to have an agenda in politics. The issue here is getting this country through this nomination process and having some credibility left in the court and in governmental processes
and in the institutions. We're speaking with David Yepsen, host of Iowa Press, the former director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute, former national political reporter at the Des Moines Register. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. We're speaking with David Yepsen, the host of Iowa Press, a good friend of the program. Been talking about the Kavanaugh nomination hearings. And David, I mean, one thing I'm curious about, too, is kind of the important role of suburban women in these midterm elections and just how much of a political force that they've become. And we've seen it show up in some of these special congressional elections, and the whole idea of trying to rush a Kavanaugh nomination and how that would be perceived by these suburban, normally, you know, socially moderate Republican leaning women, how they would perceive that.
Well, you know, one of the healthy things about this whole Kavanaugh hearing, and really the whole Me Too movement that started with the Harvey Weinstein episodes, is it's good to have this discussion out in the open in America. There are things going on in our society that shouldn't be occurring, harassment, sexual assault. It's been swept under the carpet. So it's not pleasant. It's traumatic. But it's encouraging to see so many women coming forward and saying, Me Too. And while, as I say, while it's not pleasant, it's healthy. You got to clean out the wound before it's going to heal. And I think that's an important thing for our culture. And secondly, you're right. Suburban women are critical. Donald Trump carried women who did not go to college, and non-college women were an important part of his base. The polling now shows that by a few points, those women, many of them in the suburbs, are tired of Trump. They're not happy with Trump, and they may in fact vote for Democrats for Congress. That's going to be a huge shift in the electorate if that occurs. And one of the things I tell my friends when they're starting to shout about this thing is, go register people to vote. You know, don't argue with somebody who disagrees with you. Go out and find your friends, find people who aren't registered, and get them out. Shoe leather politics. People are tired of commercials. They're tired of junk mail. They're tired of the phone calls. What's going to be important in this election is that a lot of them are going to be won by a few votes. And people ought to expend some of this energy getting their friends to go to the polls rather than shouting at one another. I think it would be a whole lot more effective. And shoe leather politics, as you well know, in Chicago, counts for an awful lot.
Well, I wanted to spend the last couple of minutes here shifting gears to Illinois politics. And overnight, J.B. Pritzker reported putting another $20 million into his campaign, bringing him to about, I believe, $146.5 million in self-funding his campaign since March of 2017. Bruce Rauner, the governor, still at that $50 million that he put in at the end of 2016. I don't know what $20 million buys at this point, David.
Yeah, there's a law of diminishing returns here. boy, you and I have covered a lot of campaigns and looked at a lot of campaign finance reports, and I don't know what you get for the another $20 million that you haven't already gotten for the first 100. So I think when the campaign's over with, people are going to be looking at just how he spent some of that money, and it may not be being spent very wisely at this point.
Well, I do remember a good friend of ours, Chris Mooney, saying that, you know, in the way we look at things, you know, you could argue that you're wasting money. But when you have all that money, is it really wasteful if you get a vote out of it?
Yeah, and the per vote, his per vote figure will be very high. But, you know, and the odds are he wins the election. All the polling, all the indications I see is that he'll defeat Governor Rauner. Governor Rauner's in a tough position, but it's not unique. I mean, Republican governors all over the Midwest are really in a bad way. Out here in Iowa,
right,
the Republican governor is a few points behind. Scott Walker up in Wisconsin is trailing his opponent. So it's a tough year for Republicans, and Illinois is generally thought of as a Democratic state. It's going to be a good Democratic year. So, you know, Pritzker is free to spend his money as he wants to because I think it's going to be a good year for Democrats.
Well, we will know on November 6th. David Yepsen, my good friend and host of Iowa Press, who also, reminder, will be on a panel at Aurora University tomorrow night as we talk about the role of the media in covering politics. Looking forward to seeing you tomorrow night at Aurora University.
Looking forward to seeing you, Rick. Thanks for having me.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. We've been talking about the Kavanaugh hearings, Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump's nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court, the fact that the FBI is now investigating as a result of Arizona Senator Jeff Flake's move in the Senate Judiciary Committee to allow for a one-week investigation of the allegations. Donald Trump saying the FBI has free rein in this investigation. During the hearings, though, Illinois Senior Senator Dick Durbin directly asked Kavanaugh if he would want an FBI investigation.
If you, Judge Kavanaugh, turn to Don McGahn and to this committee and say, for the sake of my reputation, my family name, and to get to the bottom of the truth of this, I am not going to be an obstacle to an FBI investigation, I would hope that all the members of the committee would join me in saying, we're going to abide by your wishes, and we will have that investigation.
I welcome whatever the committee wants to do, because I'm telling the truth.
I want to know what you want to do.
I'm telling the truth.
I want to know what you want to do, Judge.
I'm innocent. I'm innocent of this charge.
And you're prepared for an FBI investigation?
They don't reach conclusions. You reach the conclusions.
No,
Senator.
But they do investigate questions.
I'm innocent.
And you can't have it both ways, Judge. You can't say here at the beginning,
I wanted a hearing
moment,
look,
I welcome
thing,
any kind of investigation.
This thing was sprung on me.
This
thing was sprung at the last minute after being held by staff. You know.
Judge?
And I called for a hearing immediately.
If there is no truth to her charges, the FBI investigation will show that. Are you afraid that they might not?
Come on, Jay Whip.
The FBI does not reach. That's a phony question.
So that was that. Then, prior to that hearing, the president held a press conference where he decried the allegations raised against his nominee and blamed Democrats and the media for sullying the reputation of Brett Kavanaugh.
It's not going to change any of the Democrats' minds. They're obstructionists. They're actually con artists because they know how quality this man is, and they've destroyed a man's reputation, and they want to destroy it even more. And I think people are going to see that in the midterms, what they've done to this family, what they've done to these children, these beautiful children of his, and what they've done to his wife. And they know it's a big, fat con job. And they go into a room, and I guarantee you, they laugh like hell at what they pulled off on you and on the public.
That's President Donald Trump. Well, we're going to switch subjects more local now. And joining me here in the Allstate Skyline studio is Republican State Senator John Curran from Downers Grove. And he is one of the public officials very much involved in the issues surrounding Sterigenics facility in Willowbrook. Senator, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Good morning, Rick. Thank you.
I thought, first of all, maybe we should just kind of lay out what Sterigenics, what this issue is. And I because I think, you know, people peripherally might have heard something about something going on in Willowbrook, but don't really know what's going on. Maybe you could just explain, what is Sterigenics, what do they do, and why is there an issue?
Sure, absolutely, Rick. Sterigenics is a facility that operates in Willowbrook. It has since 1984. It sterilizes both medical supply equipment, surgical equipment, and does also food sterilization. So the medical supply equipment is the big bulk of what they do at the facility, and they use a gas called ethylene oxide in order to sterilize that equipment. Why this has become very important is in 2016, the US EPA reclassified ethylene oxide to a class 1 carcinogen. So it is now a known carcinogen. We only have a few known carcinogens amongst substances. And it also came to the conclusion that it is 60 times more potent, 60 times more likely to cause cancer than previously believed. So based upon that, the U.S. EPA did some air sampling in the area and found that, in fact, based upon the new science on ethylene oxide, that this poses a public hazard, public health risk in terms of cancer.
Where previously that was not the decision.
Correct. So Sterigenics will state that they've always been operating under their air permit and the limits set in the air permit. However, that air permit is viewed by many, including myself, to be out of date at this point because we now have new science. Yeah, we have new science, we have new standards, and we know that this is a much more harmful chemical or substance than previously thought.
And where is this facility actually? I mean, how? Give us an idea of
sure.
The location.
Sure. I mean, it is just east of Route 83. It's behind a large shopping center, right? And it's two facilities, and right between the two facilities, you have the Village Hall, the police department, you know, all the municipal works for Willowbrook. And then around that, you are surrounded by dense suburban residential neighborhoods. So, I mean, there is a large residential population in and around this facility that is exposed to this emission.
Have there been research done on whether like a cancer cluster exists?
So there's a lot of catch-up going on right now. So, we were notified in late August, and the Illinois Department of Public Health is started the process on that cancer cluster research study. So that's going on. That's kind of one component. Another component is Sterigenics did upgrade their emissions equipment. They had backflow that was going out without any process that is now coming through their scrubbing process, and that was just tested, and those test results are being analyzed right now. But there is also additional follow-up testing in terms of air quality, what's called ambient air monitoring, that the US EPA just this week committed to conducting. So,
well, and I want to talk more about that and just about the efforts that you and others, the county board members, have been making here, and you know where things stand in the process. We're talking to Republican State Senator John Curran from Downers Grove about the Sterigenics controversy in Willowbrook. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, joined here in the Allstate Skyline studio by State Senator John Curran, Republican from Downers Grove. We're talking about the Sterigenics controversy going on in Willowbrook, the Sterigenics facility, and the release of ethylene oxide gas, which the company uses to sterilize medical and other instruments. And now that has been classified as a known cancer-causing agent. A lot of activity going on by local officials involving Sterigenics. Senator, you had mentioned that just last week the U.S. EPA said that it would be doing additional testing around the facility. Is that sufficient enough?
It's a necessary step. It's not the end point.
I mean, because a number of people said just, I mean, House Republican Leader Jim Durkin, you shut it down.
Right. Shut it down. Well, I mean, we called upon Sterigenics to shut down until we get all this sorted out. What is the, and get good data and good analysis on what is the public health risk here. Unfortunately, they didn't heed that call, and they've continued to operate as under the law right now they're permitted to do. Now that we have the results, we've asked the EPA to step in, and we just had this meeting on Friday with the U.S. EPA here in Chicago. Leader Durkin, as you mentioned, and myself asked them to, County Board Member Greg Hart, shut down right now. Shut them down now. Now you have your results. You're laying out a timeline for us and how long it's going to take you to analyze this. We cannot risk this continued exposure as we go through the U.S. EPA process. That's a big part and source of the frustration, I think, borne upon the residents, is we don't have answers. We don't have good scientific answers to very important, pertinent questions, and yet they're continuing to allow this facility to operate.
And we don't have, like, the historical either. Which,
you know,
is...
and when you look back at the historical, it's even more bleak. I mean, there was a significant reduction in the amount of ethylene oxide that this facility put into the air in 1999. But 1998, to give you a frame of reference, last year you're talking about 5,500 pounds of ethylene oxide, which the U.S. EPA came in, measured, and said that this is an elevated cancer risk. This is well above our benchmark, our top threshold of 1 in 10,000, an increased risk of 1 in 10,000. That's the U.S. EPA's top threshold. Anything above that, they demand action. This was well above that, and at 5,500 pounds. You go back to 1998, they were putting out over 30,000 pounds of this into the air. I mean, so, and this is a scary substance. You know, this is a mutagen. It causes, it causes a change in your cells. And, you know, that's how the cancer comes about. And it is something that builds up over time. I mean, they measure this in lifetime exposure. So any sort of study has to take into account the significant exposure in the area going back to 84, when the releases from this facility are much greater than what they are since the upgraded equipment occurred on July 27th.
Well, and that the upgraded equipment becomes an issue here, too, because the company's argument is, well, you have to take a look at the steps we've taken, and so we need to continue operating so we can see what the effect is of that upgraded equipment.
Well, that's done now. So, I mean, if you want to pin everything on the ambient air sampling, then I suppose it needs to continue to operate. But we have the stack test done. The U.S. EPA has their data. And they're going through their process now that they laid out for us. So now there is no reason for that facility to remain operating while we go through this process.
So what is the process?
So, they have to certify results, run all the checks to make sure that the data they have is good and accurate, that there was not any sort of leaks or malfunction in the testing process. That's going to take about 2 weeks. And then after that, they didn't do a model. They model the results, and based upon that model, they then calculate new cancer risk assessments.
Do you think the EPA has acted fast enough in this? Both state and federal?
Neither agency has. I mean, and, both agencies, especially, well, the U.S. EPA drove the bus on this, but the Illinois EPA was notified at certain points. This goes back to mid-May when they first took samplings in the air, and June 23rd they came to a conclusion that we have a problem here. They suspected a problem. That's why they did the sampling.
Who is they?
I'm sorry, the U.S. EPA.
Okay.
And the U.S. EPA, June 23rd, notified the company that there's a problem here. Willowbrook, did not get notified. The village of Willowbrook, the officials, did not get notified until August 22nd. So from May 23rd to August 22nd, no one in the community, no one that represents the community, knew anything about this. Willowbrook was notified August 20th. So that's a two-month lag that should never have happened. I mean, that's a complete breakdown in protocol communication. And the US EPA owns that.
And any explanation for
no
that?
No explanation.
Just the bureaucracy.
Apology, not a good process, won't happen again. We are, course correcting on that.
EPA's, I mean, we becomes a frequent target of criticism, of overregulation and, burdensome regulation, those kinds of things. But at the same time, here you have a very serious health issue. And it becomes part of the kind of the bureaucracy.
Absolutely. And I mean, we're talking cancer here. We're talking health, quality of life. This is essential as to why the EPA exists. The US EPA is essential as to why the Illinois EPA exists. So we need them to step up in this manner, protect the residents, protect the quality of life and the health of the residents in the area.
Now, I know that also you and Leader Durkin have talked about Lisa Madigan, about some process there for,
Yes, I want to pursue any and all. So, I mean, the US EPA, the Illinois EPA have the ability to act on the air pollution standards. At the same time, the Attorney General, I've asked her to look into, and they are looking into it, reopening the air permit based upon the unknown nature of this substance when
because
it was issued
the permit
in 2015.
Right, because the permit was issued predating the
reclassification,
right.
Yes. And I've also filed legislation to do the same thing. So that permit should absolutely be reopened. This should now be viewed. The standard on issuing this permit should be viewed that this is a class one carcinogen, 60 times more potent than what we previously thought. And those facts need to be part of the determination process and whether or not an air permit is even appropriate. I don't think it is. I mean, in this residential area, but, their process needs to take that into account.
Isn't there any kind of injunctive relief to force them to shut down?
Under the Air Pollution Act or air pollution standards, that's a possibility where the Illinois Attorney General or the US EPA could move on that.
But nothing.
And they haven't yet. A lot of it's been we need the new results because any sort of injunctive relief we seek,
you need
we're going to need evidence. And we're in the evidence gathering phase. You understand why they permitted them to continue to operate because they needed to gather their evidence.
Right.
They have it now. So now we're asking them to take another look at that question and to actually shut it down until we get this all figured out.
We'll be following this story. Republican State Senator John Curran from Downers Grove, thank you so much for joining me in the studio and letting folks know where things stand on that issue.
Thank you, Rick. I greatly appreciate it.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune. This is a little bit of organizational matters here, but Donald Trump appeared before the United Nations last week, among all the things going on. And speaking to the United Nations, he touted the accomplishments of his administration, which drew a curious response from the delegates at the UN.
1 year ago, I stood before you for the first time. In this grand hall, I addressed the threats facing our world, and I presented a vision to achieve a brighter future for all of humanity. Today, I stand before the United Nations General Assembly to share the extraordinary progress we've made. In less than 2 years, my administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country. America's so true. Didn't expect that reaction, but that's okay.
That's President Trump appearing before the UN. Later, he and his administration said that people were laughing with him, not at him. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Skyline studio is Democratic State Comptroller Susana Mendoza. Madam Comptroller, thank you for joining me.
Sure. Good morning, everyone.
So the Democratic Party established this panel of women to take a look at issues involving sexual harassment and how they're dealt with from the political organizational side.
Right.
And of course, you know, political campaigns don't have an HR. You know, and here in the burgeoning Me Too movement, we've seen issues in both Republican Party, Democratic Party involving harassment issues. And so you and Melinda Bush, state senator, and State Representative Carol Ammons were charged with putting this panel together and to basically come up with recommendations on how to handle it, or recommendations on how this should be dealt with. Tell me one about just the process that led to the recommendations that you're now issuing.
Sure. Well, thanks for that question. The process is really important because it's really generally what informed the report. And that process was that we went to six different cities across the state of Illinois. We were in Rockford, in Chicago, in Springfield, in Edwardsville, in Carbondale. And where am I missing? Did I say Spring? Oh, Champaign-Urbana. And we met with hundreds of women from both parties, by the way, who came to share their stories, but also their recommendations, what they would think would be things that should change within the campaign structure to, number one, provide a safe environment for women to feel comfortable working in, right? So that you're not constantly worrying about being sexually harassed or knowing how you should handle that if that situation were to arise. But then also, what ended up happening was I think we really kind of began this panel with a thought that it was all going to be about sexual harassment and how to deal with that. But the women who came to these sessions, frankly, not that we lost focus or shift of that, because we didn't. It was always first and foremost. But it really became more of an issue of, in order to ever be able to say that we are working towards eradicating the issue of sexual harassment, the entire culture needs to change. And the only way that that will change is if more women get elevated into positions of power where they're the ones, frankly, making the rules that think of women while they're making them, right?
So empowerment, to be in leadership positions because it's the leadership
that makes the
that
rules.
Exists now.
Yeah.
So
you think about, like, for example, look what's happening. It's never been more timely. You know, our report was dropped, and then the next day it was at the Kavanaugh hearings, right? And you look at the makeup of that Senate Judiciary panel. Certainly on the Republican side, there's not a single woman, right? Everyone looks exactly the same. You could take one guy and just substitute him for the other. They even look the same, right? And these are people that were listening to testimony during the Anita Hill days. Like, not much has changed. No lessons have been learned. But I really truly believe, as do most women with rational thought, that if that Senate Judiciary panel looked more reflective of the actual population and had more women on it, or people of color, that they would be looking at this process in a very different way. And so,
well, even in some respects, that was acknowledged because the Senate Republicans that control the panel had the questioning of Dr. Ford done by a woman.
Yeah, which, by the way, was a total scam, because as soon as she was done questioning, they were, I would say, very cowardly, that they weren't willing to do it themselves. Yet then when Judge Kavanaugh came before them, they didn't need the person that they remember called the assistant, right? She would be assisting. This is like a professional, successful prosecutor who they pretty much deemed as just an assistant, which is so typical, right? But at the end of the day, she was necessary for them to not come off as the aggressors that they would have been with Dr. Ford. Yet when it was time to speak with or interview Judge Kavanaugh, it was almost like a cheering squad. These guys didn't need the prosecutor anymore because, hey, you know, they were just there to apologize to Judge Kavanaugh for the ill treatment that he had received. And it was such a contrast to how Dr. Ford was treated by that very same panel.
So you say the issue goes to really empowerment, in, yep. as far as empowerment for women to change the culture.
Well, the rules that, even the laws, right? So when you talk about, there's a difference between rules and there's a difference between laws, but in the context of the political world, you think about all these laws that impact women, certainly in the issue of sexual harassment, like statute of limitations issues, right? What even constitutes sexual harassment? Keep in mind that all of these laws have been in place for so long. And who are the people primarily making the laws? These laws were made by men for men. There's very few women in legislatures or in the congressional or Senate bodies. So when the majority is making these rules, the majority is essentially men making rules that impact men more so than from the victim's perspective, oftentimes who is female. So again, this concept of, if we really want to change this stuff, it's not going to be one or two laws. It has to be like a seismic shift. And that means that women should be properly reflected, because in the population, we make up over 50% of the population on a national level and in a state level. And why are we so underrepresented when it comes to the people that are actually making the rules or the laws that impact so many women across this state?
So what needs to be, I mean, obviously,
so the parties,
how do you promote women?
So that's the problem, right? And this is what we were discussing, and or it's a huge problem. And in order to get beyond that, the parties need to make an unabashedly intentional move to elevate women within the party structures. And that's both Democrats and Republicans, or you could extend that to Libertarians and Greens. And what that means is that we make a couple of recommendations. Number one, to require diversity in a pool of potential applicants or people that are being considered to fill, let's say, vacancies, right? Or to run for offices against current incumbents. Part of the way you do that is you'd hire, we recommend that the parties hire their own directors of diversity. These folks would be specifically charged with trying to identify talent, female talent, diversified talent, right? People, depending on what part of the state you're in, folks that could run on the LGBTQ platform, people with disabilities, women, and then find them, identify them, but more importantly, get the parties then to actually invest in training these women and in putting real dollars behind their candidacy so that they actually have a fighting chance. So many of the women who have gotten as high as the Illinois legislature, for example, got there by running against the established party structures. And once they won, it's, you know, way more often than not that the parties do a really good job, both the Democratic and Republican parties, of supporting their elected female candidates. But remember, they didn't get there necessarily with the help of the party in many instances. Now, if Illinois is currently ranked sixth in the country for most women in the legislature, we have a total of 35% of our House and Senate combined are women, yet we, of course, make up over 50% of the population. Now, we're ranked sixth best, but we need to be number one. And so I'd really love to see, and I'm speaking for Carol and Melinda as well here, and all of the women who came to these panels, that Illinois could become and should become the first state in the country to flip its legislature female majority. And that would be a game changer, and it would set the tone for what's going to happen in the rest of the country.
What is the ratio in the number one state?
So Nevada is, if they were to win, they're 39%. So no one's like super close. They're just a few points ahead of us. And Nevada is poised right now that if every woman who is running for office in their state for the legislature wins, that they would be the first state in the country to flip female majority. But we don't really believe that every woman who is running, like 100% of them will win, which still gives Illinois a chance to get moving. And I guess the best example of why I think we can do this is that the three women on that panel, Melinda Bush, myself, and Carol Ammons, all three of us got elected by running against the party. I mean, you know this story, Rick. I think people may not know it, but it took me two tries to make it into the state house. Both times I ran against a candidate that was supported fully by the Speaker of the House, right? So it's not easy to do that, but eventually I won. And then once you're there, like I said, all of the women that make it have party support. But if you think of the fact that all three of us got to the legislature and make up part of that, you know, 35% or whatever, we got there by swimming upstream. Imagine what the numbers could be in Illinois if the parties intentionally put resources behind women the first time, like went out and actually recruited women to run for these key spots. And when there was a vacancy, for example, when Christine Rodonio, the highest ranking female in the Republican Party, decided to retire, there was a group of 10 men waiting to get replaced or get put in that position, and they didn't even really essentially look at female candidates. Like, that is a missed opportunity. It reduces that number down from 35%. But more importantly, we're moving in the opposite direction of how we should be moving in Illinois, but we can change that.
We're speaking with Democratic State Comptroller Susana Mendoza about the panel that the Democratic Party put together and their recommendations on dealing with sexual harassment and promotion of women into political leadership roles. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, joined here in studio by Susana Mendoza. She is the Democratic State Comptroller. We're talking about issues involving the panel that she served on and recommendations with how to deal with sexual harassment. But we did have a caller briefly who just, after the talk about trying to get to a 50-plus-1 majority of women in the General Assembly, mm-hmm. who wanted to know, do you believe only women should run?
No, not at all. I think, you know, everybody who thinks that they can make a difference in the world should run or in their state. I do, though, feel, though, that when people say that, there's like an expectation that we're trying to treat women unfairly or give them an unfair advantage. And that's just not the case. We just want to be treated as equals. And we, frankly, do make up more of the population than the men do. But we're woefully underrepresented and have been our entire history. So I just, what we're saying is it's time to even the field, the playing field, and that women should have just as strong or an equal voice as the men do.
Let's talk about some of these recommendations. And as you were saying off air, political campaigns are kind of short-lived operations.
Yeah, they're short-lived. So unlike your traditional workplace, like we're here, somebody could work here for, you know, 10 months or 10 years or more and would know where to report because there's an HR department or stuff like that. In campaigns, they might last 2 weeks to at most maybe like a year and a half, right, before the campaign's over. So even, you know, there might be an incident that happens towards the end of a campaign and the campaign is over before you even have a legit chance to report it. So it's not feasible to have campaigns have their own HR systems, but it is for like the political party structures themselves, right? And that's why we're recommending that, number one, the parties as a whole adopt clear and non-negotiable policies that go beyond the law. Because, Rick, another thing is that campaign workers and volunteers and independent contractors are not even covered under current workplace laws. So that's why this is a whole gray area. And we have to establish new rules that, you know, are more like policies and cultures that campaigns adopt for their own campaigns, but that also the parties themselves could do things like provide anti-harassment training to everyone that's involved in a campaign. And then here's the best part. If those campaigns that are running for office tomorrow don't want to abide by these sexual harassment trainings, they don't think it's that important, then we want the parties to tie funding and resources to campaigns based on whether or not they adopt policies and participate in these trainings. That's a huge difference. You think you're too cool and that you know everything you need to know about, or frankly, you don't really respect women or your campaign workers, then don't expect to get any support or resources from the parties. We have to be intentional about making this change happen. And then the other cool thing that we did was we came up with, we're saying that you need to really develop responsible and reasonable, I would say, policies for consensual romantic relationships and alcohol use.
I thought that was a very interesting topic for you guys to address because of the nature of campaigns.
Yeah, they're so short-lived, but they're also social by nature. A lot of time people meet on campaigns or they even join campaigns. It's kind of like, I don't want to say like to meet and date other people, but that's just the reality of what happens. But we also, because we acknowledge that these are social and fun, ideologically driven social groups, right, that things happen when there's alcohol prevalent at fundraisers or at parties and long nights, people working in close proximity to each other for, you know, a very intense period of time, that, you know, people enter into these romantic relationships or people ask people out. And what we're saying is that's okay, but be responsible about it. We've kind of instituted this one ask rule. And the one ask rule is this. If you're interested in somebody, you want to ask that person out, you know, go ahead, but you only get one try. And if you get anything other than an unequivocal yes, it's a no. And don't ask again. Now, there's a second opportunity for you. If, let's say, it's a, you ask a girl out and she says no, or I want to think about it, that means no. But then she changes her mind. Well, it's 2018. It'll be 2019 next year, right? She can ask you out. She gets one try. If you change your mind, you don't want to date her anymore, done. So the whole point is, you know, take no as an answer and stop right there. And if you have this one ask rule, people know the rules. They don't have to ask about what the rules are. You know I'm going into this, and just follow them. That's all we're asking.
And this is, as you use the term party, it's plural. This is designed to be party neutral.
Oh, for sure. We really hope that every major party, and in Illinois, there's really two big, huge ones, and that's, of course, the Democrats and the Republicans. But the Libertarians and the Green parties, as they grow in size and scope here, can take these recommendations and run with them, and even, we would hope, improve upon them. But this is not something that we want for Democrats. It's something we want for women. And women come in all shapes and colors and all party labels. And this is really meant to help women feel more comfortable getting involved in a space that they care about, which is politics and the future of our states.
That's Democratic State Comptroller Susana Mendoza. Madam Comptroller, thank you so much for joining me this
morning.
Thanks
for having me, always.
Well, that's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, my good friend David Yepsen, host of Iowa Press, State Senator John Curran, Republican from Downers Grove, and Democratic State Comptroller Susana Mendoza. And most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening.